Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with Atlanta-based jazz drummer Dana Fitzsimons. Along with pianist Bill Graham and bassist Brandon Boom, they released the new 2022 CD called Fault Lines. He feels that music often reflects the psychological or emotional state of the musician at a particular point in time. Dana has been an ardent fan of free jazz for many years. He graduated from Ithaca College with a degree in music and spent some time touring. But with a young family to support, he put his music career on hold for a while to get a degree from William & Mary Law School. Today, he is both a top-notch musician and a very successful trusts and estate attorney. He opens up about his life and modern living. Enjoy.
Yeah, I was just, for some reason, when I woke up this morning, I was thinking about that. There's bits of pieces of interviews that I listened to, and someone told me recently, you know, I was like, I had something about what are they looking forward to, and they're like just waking up in the morning or something like that. Just that's a biological accomplishment enough.
Well, I mean, but if you don't go through this pandemic and have an intense focus on right now and appreciate waking up on the right side of the dirt, then you're just not paying attention, man.
I agree, you know, and I thought too, from an artistic standpoint, you know, there's been so many periods, I think, in our lives where there hasn't been this magnanimous moment in human history where artists can grab onto and have so much inspiration, or right now it's just, it's a fertile playground of all kinds of things going on.
Yeah, I mean, positive and negative. I mean, there's incredible tears at the social fabric, which are, you know, people are trying to rip people apart right now. And that creates so much tension that music can come out of that. We've seen that a bunch of times in American history. And then the positive of just getting through it. A lot of people sort of reordered their priorities during this period and, you know, got closer to family and, you know, kind of got a healthier work-life balance. I mean, a lot of good things. The whole work-from-home thing is long overdue. You know, a lot of people stopped grinding out commutes on the highway, and so a lot of good stuff, too.
Yeah, there have been a lot of silver linings. So, speaking of the pandemic, speaking of going through this time here, you kind of touched on it a little bit. Before we get to this new meditative music for troubled times with the Cheap Ensemble, I want to know, how did you survive COVID? How did this whole period, especially as an artist, with there being no live shows and all that, now you have music coming out on the tail end of this thing?
Yeah, great. So the Cheap Ensemble record was from 2017. The new one is called Fault Lines. Yeah, so interesting. For me, I never had a... two things came out of it. I never had the luxury of the time to do, at least not lately, with kids and jobs and life and, you know, everything swirling around, the kind of, you know, sort of big chunks of time where I could think about my sound, my physical approach to the drum set, and practice some new things and, you know, practice not only physically the drums, but also think about how I wanted to sound, you know, how I was hearing the drums and sort of see where I could go with that, right? And some of it's just physical. It's how you're setting up. Some of it's how you're tuning, exploring new sounds rather than just grabbing the drums and going out the door. You've got this period of time where you can say, well, let me see what happens if I tune it like this or set it up like this or try this kind of cymbal or whatever. And like, what's my sound? I never had that kind of intense periods of time for that. And so that was the early stage of the pandemic, was taking advantage of the opportunity to really just sort of practice. And then you just start getting where you're starting to play good and starting to hear some things and you want to see what that sounds like with other musicians. And then there's a frustration period, right, where you're ready to just explode out of your box and see what you can do musically, but there's no opportunities to do it at all. So I would say the pandemic for me had, you know, two phases. One, the first phase was sort of comforting. It was like, okay, let me take a breath and sort of explore who I want to be musically and what I want to sound like and what I can sound like. And then the second stage where you're chomping at the bit and you got nowhere to go. And so scheduling the recording session was actually a little bit born out of the frustration, which was, I'm ready to do something on the drums and I'm ready to play with other musicians and I'm ready to play with these guys, because we had started to touch on things right before the shutdown. I just went ahead and scheduled the recording session, and in part just to kind of relieve that buildup and see what could happen. So some of the music is explosive because it's coming out of, you know, of just a lockdown. In fact, the first thing we played in the studio was the track Borders that shows up on the record. That's first take, first song, first thing we played when they started rolling tape. And it gets pretty physical and pretty explosive over the course of that 5 minutes. And that was actually the pressure release. That was us playing our first notes together after the lockdown. So that's the sort of the musical overview. Personally, it was just, instead of running around and sitting in stop-and-go traffic and traveling all the time, it was an intense period of time of connecting to my kids before they, left. And I became an empty nester. So I had, right before they left, I had this big chunk of time with them, which was great, too.
Talk to me a little bit about how you got into jazz. How did music begin for you, this journey?
You mean, going way back now?
Yeah, we're going way back.
Well, first of all, my parents... my father was a musician and my mother was a frustrated musician. So my mother had always wanted to be a singer, and she had grown up in the 50s and the 60s and was real into Motown and doo-wop, and she had a nice voice. But that wasn't practical for child of immigrants, got to get a job, got to do something practical. And so it was always go get a job, get into the workforce. And her folks didn't really have the luxury of supporting her doing anything creative, but my mother loved music. My father was actually a good trumpet player. He played in some soul bands, and he played in drum and bugle corps, and also he had a Motown style band where he sang and played trumpet. I think it was called the Flames or something, the way bands were called in the 60s, and they played dances and parties. But both of their musical lives got cut short by circumstance. So my mother had to get into the workforce at 18 and right after graduating high school and try to make a living. And my father went off to Vietnam. It was a Navy Special Warfare Unit person in Vietnam, got hurt over there, spent a year in Japan. And by the time he came back, it was just trying to get into the workforce and get to work. And so they were very musical and loved music. And also my father and mother both wanted us out of the factory. So my dad worked in the factory. They didn't want us to go into the service. My dad gotten pretty badly hurt. And so they saw two ways out of the factories, which one was either sports or music. So they pushed sports and music on us. And the sports stuck with my brother. He went on to go to college on an athletic scholarship, and music. I played baseball, but music really grabbed in with me. And so I went to college for the trumpet, actually, and I was the first person in my family line to ever go to college. It was sports and music, though, that got my brother and I out of either working service jobs or becoming soldiers and sailors or ending up in the factories. So that's how it started. And I sort of took to the trumpet right away and went to college playing the trumpet and then eventually moved my way to the drums, which I had always sort of had an affection for. But the music was in the family because my parents sort of brought it into our lives.
So your bio mentions that you can lead kind of a double life. Kind of expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, so I started thinking I was going to be a full-time musician and music teacher. And so I did a little bit of light touring when I was younger and on trumpet. And then I ended up playing drums with a hard rock band in Philadelphia right after I graduated music school. And then I was a high school band director in Virginia. I taught elementary school general music in Florida, and I was a high school band director, finally got my high school band, in Virginia. And that went pretty well. But I was in a school with a lot of politics around the music program and the classic tension between funding for the arts versus funding for football. And I had a principal that didn't really support the music program, and I had a tough teaching situation. And so I ended up, and the program was underfunded, and it was just sort of a miserable experience, even though the kids were great. The teaching of music was great. So I left that job because it was just too frustrating. And I ended up going to law school. Something really connected with me in law school. I'd never done anything academic. It had always been music, but something resonated with me with the law. And I ended up taking to it and doing really well in law school. And then I went on to become a lawyer. I've been a lawyer for 21 or 22 years now. And during that entire time, I've kept, sort of half my life in music. I played steady Friday night cocktail gigs and, you know, weddings and, you know, everything you do just to keep playing. And so I just did everything I did, even though I was working, you know, 15, 16-hour days, 6 days a week, 51 weeks a year at a big law firm back when I started. You know, I just fought tooth and nail to just hold on to a musical life. So I'd, you know, work all day and then play a few hours in a bar on Friday night and then just be exhausted and then do it all over again. But just kept in hanging on to it to try to stay musical and try to, so, you know, I've had a slower maybe musical development because I haven't been able to focus on it full time, but I've stuck at it and kept trying to find sort of my own musical voice over the last, you know, 20 something years of being a lawyer.
But I guess that's the real point of life, is that you find something that doesn't feel like a job, or you follow your passion, your dream, you know, I mean, no matter what, you know, that you're still, you're fulfilling both sides of your right and left and sides of your brains and your head and all of that. So how do those kind of come together for you? You know, there's a pragmatic, practical side. And then of course, jazz is very artistic and improv. How do those worlds coexist and feed off of each other and make you a better lawyer or a better musician?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, to me, inside my brain, performing jazz music and being an attorney don't really feel different inside my brain. Being a lawyer, whether you're in a meeting, and I used to do trial work in front of courts, you know, all over Virginia and appellate courts and what have you. But whether you're in a meeting with clients, or whether you're in a court and you're doing battle with another lawyer, or whether you're just presented with a problem under intense time pressure and you have to come up with a solution, it's all about taking in a lot of information fast, seeing a way through it, and reacting quickly, right? It's all action, reaction, but being a lawyer, that all happens very fast. In court, in a client meeting, or just because you have a problem that you have to solve and they need an answer right away. It's all about you're receiving a ton of data and you're finding a way through it and how to navigate it and how to respond to it. And it requires incredibly fast reaction times. To me, that's no different than being on a stage performing improvisational music. You're getting data, you're listening intensely, you're taking in, you're paying very close attention to everything, and then you're trying to find your voice through that. You're trying to navigate your way through it. And for me, the sort of grace under pressure and being accustomed to intense situations that came from being a musician. You know, you're on stage, thousands of people are staring at you, and you have to deliver under that pressure. In that moment, there's no do-overs. That kind of training, I think, was a perfect training ground for practicing law. And again, they just don't really feel that different to me. Now, the discipline that comes from a complex and sophisticated law practice, thinking down the road, thinking multiple steps ahead, sort of the taking care of business, the paying attention to the details, and not being so swept away in your own self-indulgent artistic vision that, you know, you don't speak coherently and present things in an organized way, that also has been sort of a positive influence on my musical life, because I'm much better. You know, when I was young, it was just like, so caught up in yourself and your playing, and you know, you're sort of very inward focused and your playing is more selfish and you're disorganized and you don't know how to book a gig, organize a gig, organize people, motivate people. You don't understand how to relate to people in a mature way to get out of them the best of what you can get out of them. All of those skills, I think, really develops for me on the law side, and you bring those into music. And you understand how to take care of people, how to communicate with people as humans, not musically now, just as people, and how to manage people in a way that they'll maximize their creative output with you and for you. All of that came from practicing law. So I feel like the two things could not complement themselves more than they have. They're really an incredibly good fit. And again, they just don't feel that different to me. I've brought all of the dealing with pressure and the intense listening and the quick reaction times for music and all of the sort of empathy and human understanding and organizational parts and the discipline parts from law practice into my musical life. And so I feel like they all sort of swirl together now.
So now that we're getting back to live music more, what do you hope we all collectively realize about the power of live music, both musician and the audience?
You know, there was a moment before the pandemic where I did a night with a group of musicians, and we did the music of Peggy Lee and Benny Goodman, the small group stuff, and so that era of Benny Goodman. And we did a night of that, because I like to play traditional jazz, too, in addition to avant-garde stuff. And so we did a night of that. And there was a woman who sat in the front row, and she was about 95 years old. And her children, who were in their 70s, right, had checked her out of a nursing home and brought her out to hear music, because she loved Peggy Lee. And she sat right in the front row. And everybody on the bandstand and everybody around her watched this woman sing along to every song and watched decades melt off her face. She smiled. She looked like she was getting visibly younger in real time over the course of that gig. And I never forgot that as the lesson of the power of music to heal the human condition. And at a time now where the level of stress on every single human walking around, I mean, maybe the privileged few are not feeling this, but the vast majority of people, between inflation and gas prices and political turmoil and risk of disease and risk of death, and life expectancies are down, and the country seems like it's trying to tear itself apart again, and the economic wages being stagnant and prices being higher, and, you know, a sense that maybe opportunities might be closing for younger people. There's so much, and of course, war raging in part of the country right now, and the threat of it in other places. There's so much pressure day to day right now that the possibility that music can provide some healing and some relief from that, or at a minimum, give you a couple hours of your life where you don't think about it and focus on it, and you can free up your mind to just think about higher things, or, you know, healthier things, or spiritual things, or wherever music takes you, or just makes you happy. If it just drowns out the noise of all this suffering for a couple hours, that has immense value. So I think that the power to heal, and also for me, instrumental music that is leans a little towards the avant-garde, to me also has the power to free up higher level thought if you let it surround you a little bit. So I think that's the biggest lesson for me. I hope people can reconnect to that. And I think when the few times that I've played out, now that things are starting to come on live, you get a real sense of that, that people really need to just not think and feel about all the things that are so negative every day. It just gives them a little bit of a break, and I think that has real value.
Absolutely. I love that visual of her, the years, you know, just kind of melting away. That's a great answer.
Oh, man, it was amazing. Yeah,
absolutely, yeah, and that's the power of it. So everyone has a perception or an idea of who they think you are, your family, your friends, your fans, your clients, everyone around you, but ultimately you live your life. What's your perception of you? Who do you think you are? How's that?
Yeah, well, I can tell you what I'm trying to be. You know, or at least what I aspire to be. And I've tried to not pretend to be one way, because I think that's the way I have to be when I'm in the jazz world, and another way that I think I have to pretend to be when I'm in the legal world. I really try to just speak with my authentic voice and not try to pretend to be anything other than my father's son, who grew up scrappy and poor and has just been hustling for years to build a life. You know, I try not to pretend to be fancier or from a more affluent background than I come from. I try to be kind of the same scrappy, hard worker that I've always been. And I try to speak with this same voice that I'm talking with you now. I try to use that in the legal setting. I don't try to talk above my station or my personality. And I also don't try to change how I speak when I'm in the jazz world. I just try to hold on to being myself through the whole way. And I talk the same way with my kids as I do with clients, as I do with musicians. And I'm just trying to be myself in every setting, rather than trying to be different people in all those settings.
Beautiful. Dana, thank you for taking some time out today. This has been wonderful. Good luck with the album and the return to the stage.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate you including me.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in Virginia, Atlanta, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Dana for his time, music, and story. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com. And for everything Neon Jazz, go to TheNeonJazz.blogspot.com. For all things Joe Domino, go to JoeDomino.com. And there, you can donate via Patreon or PayPal. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.